screen, but still, I'm here. So I look back for a lot attached to the trial. It's a bit unusual, but I do appreciate being with you this evening. This morning, I gave my introduction to philosophy final at Texas Wesley, and I learned things about philosophy I never knew. One thing I asked for the name of a British empiricist, I was after John Locke, and I asked for things that one person, but Aristotle. She did pass. Now another one had Descartes. I never knew Descartes was English. I mean, if he weren't always dead, he would turn over in his grave at the idea. At any rate, still, it was interesting, and at least I got them all graded, so that part was extremely good. Well, when I talked with Carl about this, I said that what I'd like to do is look at Stoicism, and especially its its effect on early Christianity. Now, my doctorate was in early church history, so it's sort of, I'm sort of what you might call a philosopher by default, because the period I looked at, cutting off in 451, we see that Plato was sort of their patron saint. So, but yet, as I look back, I see places where Stoicism reared its head, and I won't say ugly head, because it had too much good to offer. So I want to tell you just some of the things here about the observations I have noted. The problem with my coming in to you as it is, without knowing you, I have the danger of talking down to you, because I'm used to introductory philosophy students. Well, on the other hand, the students you know too much and talking work in the clouds, and 6 feet 2 inches already gives me a good start. So I'll probably offend some of you one way or the other, so please bear with me, and I can only plead ignorance at this particular point.
I'm telling you, you're going to offend us all.
Okay, well, I've got an automatic start there. Okay. Well, Stoicism, I think, again, many of us are familiar with it, at least in part, but when I ask my students what they think Stoicism is, almost invariably I get the idea a person that doesn't show any emotion, or a person who is still on the lip, and certainly that was part of it. But I think many of you are well aware, most of you, that there is so much more to it than that. And it was a very powerful philosophy that attracted so many people. It was particularly popular, I find, in Rome, partially because it dealt with the idea of strength, making people strong, how to stand firm, for things like that. And also the idea of do your duty, live virtuously. This had great appeal as well. And of course, they came up with philosophers like Seneca, who was certainly no slouch when he came to that. So Stoicism certainly had considerable appeal there. Now, when I started doing my research for this talk, I went back and I began to find, of course, that Stoicism has been through various incarnations, shall we say. Of course, we know that it was supposedly founded by Zeno, but a little bit later, the one who was the best-known Stoic in early Stoicism was Chrysippus. And yet, he said that he was regarded as a heretic. And yet, when we read his writings, we're not sure exactly how much of Zeno's stances he changed. So we're just not sure. But that was what we call the early Stoicism, and later on we find, of course, they come up with Epictetus, who was noted, of course, for being a slave, and yet a philosopher. And that was another thing about Stoicism that was nice. Anybody could be a Stoic, as it were. So, in other words, they were blind to class distinctions at that point. And many of you know the story that Epictetus, his master, once accused him of something and actually broke his leg during torture. But Epictetus said, I've still got the power over how I react to this. And therefore, he refused to react the way many people would if they were having their legs broken. I don't even want to think what I would have done in a situation like that. And of course, we find that Marcus Aurelius was a Stoic and a very noted one. He is often regarded as one of the best of the emperors from that particular period. How many of you saw the movie Gladiator a few years back there? Ah, yes. You remember Richard Harris played the part of Marcus Aurelius, who was suffocated by his horrible son, who was horrible all the way through. But still, we see that there he came across as a good guy. What many people do not realize is that while he might have been good for Rome, he was certainly not good to those early Christians up in Lyon and beyond. There, he would have unleashed a violent persecution against them because, of course, if you didn't worship the Roman gods, you were probably undermining the security of Rome. And so, consequently, the Christians were regarded with grave suspicion, and Marcus Aurelius took it a bit farther than that. But I want to look at some of the things that appealed to people about Stoicism and some things that we could learn today. One is, of course, they were quite materialistic. They were partially in reaction to Plato's idea about the two worlds, the world that we live in, which, of course, is merely a shadowy copy of the real or eternal world, which is where all the good things were. And we find that the Stoics rebelled against that. And they said, this life is what we've got. Let's go for it. Now, I couldn't find any of my sources if there was any direct influence of Aristotle here. I think there almost certainly has to have been. I'll count later on, see how many of you I offended when I say that. But we see that Aristotle was the one who said, well, if the other world, that spiritual world exists, we have no proof of it, so let's make the most of the world we've got. Well, that was very much the Stoic attitude. I think we are aware that they were strong believers in fate, that definitely their lot in life was decreed for them, and while we control our reaction to fate, we can't really control some of the things that happened to us at that particular point. So there was that strong emphasis on fate. Likewise, we see that they were usually monotheistic, again, following along the line of Aristotle. I'm sure many of you are aware that he believed in God, but he was a rather personality-less God, shall we say. God, the unmoved mover, and yet we see that the Stoics were, that appealed to them because of the idea of a passionless God. They liked that idea. And many of you know, too, of course, that they believed in cyclical worlds, that everything was in the process of change, and that there was no permanence, and that sooner or later this world would be dissolved in fire, and it would start all over again. There are days when I feel like that. But still, this was what their idea was, that there was no permanence, and everything that was coming along was going to be, well, recycled. This sounded like ecology, but it wasn't quite that far along. But as I thought about this, there were several things I could see relations to. One, of course, is Buddhism. Because we see that Buddhism stresses that there is nothing permanent, that we should enjoy the things of life when they come our way, but then we shouldn't try to hang on to them because they're going to change whether we like it or not, you see. So there's that idea of what they call shunyata, the idea that there is nothing permanent, there is zero-ness there, and yet we should enjoy the serendipities of life when they come along, and the early Stoics would certainly have sympathized with that. But in more recent times, process theology in the theological realm is the idea that everything is in transit, including God. And you see in that view of cyclical worlds, the Stoics took that same idea, that there's going to be, everything's going to come to an end and be recycled, including God. So at that point, it's more like the modern phenomenon of process theology. One of my dear friends in seminary had to do a paper on John P. Cobb, a process theologian out in California. And you thought German and Russian were foreign languages. I don't know what planet this guy comes from, but mercy. His language is like computer language. My friend just had senioritis and wanted to get out in the worst way. His paper was the worst thing I ever saw. The professor, who was a big, heavy, shall we say, stoic-looking fellow, but with a wicked sense of humor, he told Jim he had taken a difficult man and made him totally obscure. One of the funniest put-downs I ever heard. It was very much in keeping with that professor. But Jim did graduate from seminary. But still, process theology does have things in common with the Stoics. And then, of course, there was Heraclitus, that ancient Greek philosopher, who said that everything is in change. They would have definitely sympathized with that. He said, how do we know that the river that's flowing by us is the same river that was here the day before? Because if we step in it, the water is not the same, unless it's very stagnant indeed. It's flowed on, yet how can we say that, for instance, the Trinity River here in Dallas, also in Fort Worth, is the same river? It isn't, because it changes each time. So he said everything is in the process of change. So the Stoics certainly would have agreed with that. Now, one thing that's interesting about them is they emphasized virtue. They said what's important is how we live life. And, of course, they followed the virtues of their particular time. And when we talk about the early church, we're going to see places that they rebelled against some of the Stoic ideas. But, for instance, some of the Stoics would have said that wealth and riches may be okay in themselves, but they are not necessarily good. It depends on your attitude to them. In other words, they would say, don't be mastered by them. Be able to use them, we'll say, in moderation, and don't let them control your life. And, therefore, this would be the virtuous thing to do. Now, they also believed that they could enjoy family life, etc. But again, they said you could go to the banquets with the bawdy girls, also known as prostitutes, and still do it virtuously. Now, I haven't figured that one out yet. But again, it would reflect that the Greek and Roman ideas. Pardon?
I said it's easy.
Okay, it's easy. Okay, I'll take that. I want to ask for a personal testimony at that point. But we see that there is an idea of virtue being, again, in control of things, not being an extremist. And of course, this leads to the idea about their fear of strong passions. But before we deal with that, again, while I was working on this, the emphasis on virtue, I was reminded of the utilitarian philosopher John Stuart Mill. Some of you here have probably done some work with him. But he said what was good was what did the most good for the most people. Now there he took a step beyond his mentor and earlier teacher there, Jeremy Bentham, who said that it's what makes the most people happy. But guess what? There are some people like Charles Manson and Jeffrey Dahmer that are made happy by very strange things indeed. So Mill advanced this farther and said it's what does the most good for the most people. So there was that idea of virtue, again, being important. So we see that some of those Stoic angles have a way of showing up when we least expect it. But now, the fear of strong passions. I asked my students when we talked about this. We found that Stoics were very concerned about this because a strong passion, whether it be grief, or laughter, or anger, or whatever, can pull us off balance. And they were very big on balance. Now, I will say that as I get older, I am convinced one of the hardest things to achieve anywhere in life is balance. Don't go around telling people I'm in balance. They already know it anyway. But still, we have a hard time with that, you see. Not just physical balance, but keeping things in proper perspective. And the Stoics were well aware of that. And they said that a strong passion, be it grief or laughter or anger or whatever, can pull us off balance. And therefore, we are liable to make very bad decisions at that point. Now, there's a lot of truth there. I always ask my students, how many of you, in a moment of strong emotion, have made a decision that was an absolute disaster? And most of the hands go up, and the ones whose hands don't go up are just not being honest at that point. You know how it is that when we're really upset and try to eat something, chances are we'll nauseate us because we're off balance at that point. And it's been noted that our bodies are a miracle of balance because there are so many things in the atmosphere around us that are pressing in on us. Fortunately, we got enough on the inside pushing back that it keeps us in a state of balance, a little more or less. I mean, I was a kid, I was a klutz. My feet needed training wheels, and I never even learned to ride a bicycle. I realize that's heresy, but I didn't because I was a klutz. But balance in every area is so difficult to achieve. We hear always about the extremists, whether it be religion or politics or whatever, is the extremists who make the news. Isn't that right? It also sells. I'm just being rather cynical at that point, perhaps. But still, we see that the idea of the fear of strong passions is highly interesting. And yet, later on in the history of philosophy, we see there were so many others that said, without passion, we can't do much. Of course, Kierkegaard said, if you can say 2 + 2 = 4, that's fine. But when you put it to work in your own life, that's when it really begins to make sense. One pastor that had a lot to me when I was in seminary, he said that when he and his wife went to India, they heard that many missionary children die, and they knew it as a fact. But when their own child died of a blitzkrieg attack of dysentery there, they knew it at a much deeper level. Kierkegaard would say, that's exactly what I'm referring to. And he would say that was where Stoic philosophy was flawed, because he said that objectivity, keeping things completely out here, is ugly. And it develops what we would call the fat cats that sit there and talk erudite stuff, and yet it doesn't matter a whit to them what they're doing. Now, of course, it wasn't just Kierkegaard. Hume said something along the same line when he said that impressions are more important than ideas. Now, as an old guy, as a world academic, we tend to think so much of ideas, and I tell my students, ideas have a tremendous power to change the world. Look at Karl Marx, who was pretty much on the lazy side, but he was a thinker. And look what that man's ideas did to the world. I'm not saying I'm a fan of his, but I still think we need to see what ideas can do. But David Hume, and I did my doctorate in Edinburgh, and I could take you right to David Hume's grave. It wasn't that far from where my college there was. But he said that impressions are what motivate people to action. Now, that's interesting. And again, the Stoics would have been suspicious of that, but guess what? He would have been suspicious of the Stoics as well. And later on, we find that William James, he said, truth isn't just something that exists in our minds or whatever, but it's something that becomes personal when it happens to us. When we read about the horrors of Alzheimer's, certainly one of the most awful diseases in the world, that's one thing. But when it hits members of our family, suddenly it has become very personal indeed. So all three of these very important philosophers, and they're fun to teach, especially Hume, because I guess my students so upset. So sometimes all I have to do is separate the combatants at that point, you see. But it's the idea of passions can drive us to action. Well, Stoics would have been suspicious of it, but these other guys would have said, no, there's some problems there if all you do is maintain balance and are never pulled into something with personal involvement. Kierkegaard in particular would have said that. I have a bookmark that says very, very well, I would hate to go through life without having disturbed someone. That's good. I'm in danger. Okay. Now, there was something else with these Stoics, though, that I think was great. Highly interesting is their attitude to evil. They said we can't really control it that much, but we can control how we react to it. Now that's interesting. We're going to see that's one place where the early church fathers really took issue with them. But the idea of controlling your attitude, that is good. Because sometimes we live at the mercy of our moods. And that's not a good thing. And the Stoics knew that. One Scottish devotional writer, he said, moods don't go by praying, they go by kicking. Good point. The Stoics knew that. You see, that we have power over our own attitude. And of course, they said that everybody could be a Stoic, and they said that all of us have a divine spark in our lives that is part of the element of rationality that they call the logos, that good old Greek word. And they said all of us have that spark, and we need to learn to work with it and to develop it and go farther along that line. And their idea about the logos, the divine reason, they said that the universe is basically rational, and that when we are rational, we are in touch with reality. Okay, interesting, because in the last century, we've heard so much about the irrational element of the world that perhaps the Stoic attitude here might come as a refresher, sort of like the cool breeze in the middle of July in Texas. I will say no more, because last summer was an insult to humanity, but that's a different story. Okay. Now, also, I want us to look and see what was happening at the same time with the Epicureans. Now, again, I asked my students, what do you think of when you think of the Epicureans? They say, oh, it's people that believe in wine, women, and salt, or whatever, and the more familiar. Now, those of you who have studied Epicurus know that he was a very abstemious person. Very, very moderate. In fact, he said, pleasure may be the highest good, but it's better when you have it in moderation, because then when you experience it, you'll appreciate it more. He said, if you get pleasure all the time, that's sort of like Lucy and Peanuts, it says it turns sour. And so he is one who lived on a very simple diet. He lived in a very simple fashion there. Not at all what we think of as an Epicurean there. But by the same token, we find that if there was a person of that same philosophy in North Africa, named Aristippus, and he was the one that said, swing, baby, swing. The more the better. Hugh Hefner would have loved Aristippus, you see. So he said, go for it and enjoy everything you can, and the more the better. So he and Epicurus himself would have strongly disagreed. And a lot of times, people have the idea about the swinging playboy Epicurean and the puritanical Stoic fighting together. Well, Epicurus and the Stoics together, you would find that their outward behavior was pretty much the same. Interesting. So that's one of those fallacies that we come across. We've heard it so much. It's like we hear about the Puritans being so grim and stern and joyless. The idea that somewhere someone may be having a good time and that's bad news. What's interesting in American history, when we look back at the history of Massachusetts, there was a Puritan churchwoman who took her husband before the board of elders because he had been neglecting their sex life. Well, that doesn't sound like what we think of about the Puritans. The board of elders examined the evidence. Don't ask anybody what I'm afraid to ask. But they agreed that the woman was right, and they said to the husband, don't work so hard, save some room for a bedsheet bingo when you get home. Well, my paraphrase. But you can see that that's not what we think of about the Puritans. So that reminds us again that some of our old images and comparisons with which we're so very familiar just don't work. And certainly, Epicurus himself and those that were members of his school believed in a very moderate life and said, enjoy pleasure, but you'll enjoy more. Well, we said, good things in life are worth waiting for. Yes, I found that true myself. I didn't start my doctoral work until I was 43. course, I'm just 39, so I'll give you that. Logic is not my strong point. Okay. So, but we see that they were both rather abstemious. It was just in their thought processes that they were very different. Now, also the Stoics were big on logic, and this must show the influence of Aristotle. My sadistic strain shows up in my introduction to philosophy class. I always make my students work logic puzzles. Some would say they were designed by the Marquis de Sade, and I usually find my students making wax images of me and sticking pins in them, trying to work on it. When my mother was living, I tried to interest her in them. She wouldn't have touched them with a 10-foot pole. What am I saying? A 100-foot pole, because she was low on patience and had no patience about doing things like this. But we see that the Stoics were big on things like disjunctive syllogisms and categorical syllogisms. Now, I love teaching those. By the way, I hate Venn diagrams. They say they're really good for people who are pictorially minded, but I am a printed word person, so I do better when I get away from that.
How about truth tables?
Those I can do, but the Venn diagrams usually reduce me even to more of an insane state than I usually am. So, yes, truth tables I can handle if I can have time enough to work them out there. But still, logic, and the idea that the Stoics had was appearances may be deceptive. And they said, you can't prove something by a categorical syllogism or a disjunctive syllogism, just maybe it's not right. And of course, that is the way science often works, isn't it? I think of one case that Mark Twain poked fun at was in Huckleberry Finn, when they said, if you weren't supposed to look at the moon over your left shoulder, something bad would happen. And he said, Huck says, I know somebody who did, and 3 years later, he broke his arm.
3 years?
Yeah, but I thought Twain, of course, was lampooning that. Again, Finn and Mark Twain would fit very well here because there's something in that book to make everybody mad. And Mark Twain did that deliberately, and he succeeded very well. But of course, it's a tremendous novel. But still, there's an idea that, Ian Hume would have agreed, says you cannot necessarily say that anything causes something else. Now, that's a bit extreme, and that's one thing my students get very upset with, because you can't develop science. That's kind of an attitude. But the Stoics said, appearances are not always what they seem. And I think many of us could tell stories about that, how we found out that this is the case, and there were a lot of the old fables that we may have grown up with that we found out are not good. Now, my mother was a North Texas country girl, and she was convinced, and she had heard this, that if you wear underwear any other color than white, you'll probably get a bladder infection. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands. Mine today is cherry red, so too much information, I realize. But you see, that's not the case. But some people that did wear colored underwear got bladder infections, but there was no necessary connection. But some people would have staked their lives on that. How about the old business, if you play with frogs, you'll get warts? There's one, you see. We have all sorts of fables left to go by the board, and the Stoics say let's bring logic to bear in the situation and really try to see what is true and what isn't. Now, that deals with the background of Stoicism that I wanted to look at, and I want to see how the early Christians reacted to this, and certainly there were areas in their lives where they improved. One was, of course, the idea of virtue. They liked that, but the idea, and sorry, sir, about the idea that you could go to the body girls and have a good time in moderation, the Christians said, off limits, you see. So they believed in virtue, but they qualified virtue a little bit more. But the Stoic idea that we should live virtuously, they did not agree with more. They just wanted to say what made virtue what didn't. Also, the idea of self-control. That was important. If we read the letters of Paul, we see that he strongly emphasizes the idea of remaining in control of our feelings, not letting them dictate to us how we feel, or if we're having a bad day, a bad hair day, if it's called there. That doesn't mean that the whole world is going down the tubes or going to hell in a handbasket, but say we need to know about this and control our attitude, or again, put off our chambers, moves go by kicking. And the early Christians agreed with that as well. They also knew the importance of attitude. You've heard the old line about the optimist, the pessimist, the difference is role. The optimist sees the donut, the pessimist sees the hole. Yes. And I've worked with some people who are first cousins to Eeyore from Winnie the Pooh. We always hear the old too optimistic saying about every cloud is a silver lining. To some people, every silver lining is a cloud. Isn't that right? You meet some people about that, and I mean, I lived in Vermont. There you talk about the old Vermonters, and some of them can be so funny without even realizing it. You say, oh, it's a beautiful day, isn't it? Oh, yeah, but we'll pay for it. Well, maybe what winter could be like up there. And one old lady, I mean, was a marvelous person.
that she was in the hospital with an infected hand once. She said, oh, last week I could just scream with the pain. That wouldn't have done any good. You know, with that stonefish, she didn't know how funny she was. If you told her about somebody else, she would roar laughing. So, but we have control over our attitudes. And the Christians agreed with the Stoics at that point. And, of course, they also agreed with the monotheism, but we see that they reacted about the idea of an impersonal God that is really more of a force of nature, and they certainly didn't like the idea about God being included in the process of change. We'll talk more about that. Now, Marcus Aurelius' meditations were actually very popular in the early church for a while because some of what he said was absolutely in accord with Christian ideas about how to live life. So we see they were strongly in favor of these things, but there were disagreements along the line, too. One was the idea of cyclical worlds. They said they took the linear view that we started somewhere, we're going somewhere, and they might today be in favor of recycling. They would say we draw the line at the world and certainly at God. But they did believe that we live in a world where things are changing, and they would say we need to have something that does not change, and that would be God, and was also the cross of Christ, which is so central to their belief. But they said that the cyclical world's idea is that we can't buy that. And also this idea of an impermanent and impersonal God, they didn't go for that at all. They said that God is personal and caring and loving and to be trusted, and that, again, he is not some blind, impersonal force that sort of closes his eyes and says, the person I thought that's going to be thus and so. And we see, of course, that they were against some of what they perceived to be the immoralities in the pagan lifestyle, like the orgies and things of that sort. They spoke against that, and they certainly spoke against the idea of blind fate. They talk about the person that believed that everything that happened was totally predestined. He fell down a flight of stairs and looked up and said, well, I'm glad that's over with. Well, many of the Christians would have fought back against that sort of idea. And also the question of suffering, that it was just our fate to do that. Many Christians fought back, and we find people like Augustine, his earlier predecessor, Irenaeus, the Bishop of Lyon in France, who came up with ideas about how to deal with the issue of suffering. Of course, that is always an enormous issue that all of us have to deal with. Every one of us here has had some horrible pages in our lives that we have had to deal with. But the early Christians most emphatically said it is not just impersonal fate, but rather they took the idea when life hands you lemons, make lemonade, and if we can't, then it's time to go to prayer and find out how God can make lemonade out of lemons. So they began to differ there on the issue of suffering, and I say that's still not been totally resolved to everyone's satisfaction all these years later. But we see that they strongly stressed the importance of choice. The thing is, if you believe that everything is totally predestined, it's quite possible to get to the point where you can blame your bad choices on fate. And the Christian said, doesn't work that way. In the Epistle to the Hebrews, one of those anonymous letters you hear about, in the New Testament, we find there that the writer talks about Esau, the son of son of Isaac, who's twin brother to Jacob, and he made some disastrous choices on momentary decisions, and the Stoics said, what do you expect? But we see that the Christian writers stress the importance of Esau's bad choice, that we make bad choices and sometimes have to live with the fruit of them, and we can't blame God, we can't blame faith. All we can blame is our own very stupid selves when we do something like that. So they believe firmly that we have some choice there, and as I say, they believe that the world changes, but that God does not. Now, the New Testament also deals with the word logos, which means word. It's the Greek word for word, many of you know that, so don't yawn too much, please. But we see that the Christians identified with the Stoics here, when they talk about logos being the element of rationality that holds the world together, we find Paul in his letter to the Colossians saying that in Christ everything coheres, holds together. That's exactly what the Stoics would have said about divine reason. And I think that Paul said this because it was a point of communication with Stoicism, which was a very important and popular philosophy. He said, you think the divine reason holds it together, we think it's this guy Jesus that does it, and so he said we will hold on to that. Even more important, in the Gospel of John, chapter 1, John begins by talking about Christ before he's coming to earth. In the beginning was the Word. There's that logos again, you see, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Now that's a loaded verse. In fact, the Gospel of John is that way anyway. But we see that it starts out that way because to the Hebrews, word meant creation. God said, let there be light. Word, you see. God said, let there be thus and so. God said, let us make humanity in our own image. Said the word. So any Hebrew reading this would have thought, hey, John is saying that Jesus is the agent of creation. John would say, right you are, baby. And then we see the stories would have said, he is saying that Jesus is the element of rationality that holds the world together. I think John chose that word deliberately because it could be ambiguous. And he would say both those meanings are right, but he knew it would be a point of instant understanding whether he was talking with a Hebrew audience or with an audience that was familiar with Stoicism. Let's remember that an awful lot of people were. But now let's move on to the early church fathers, because that's the area that I did my doctoral work in. One that was really strongly influenced by Stoicism was Tertullian. Any of you heard or read any of Tertullian? Man, he was a fireball. I think he had to have been first cousin to the prophet Amos in the Old Testament, because neither one of them could say anything at all. Tertullian, unfortunately, is available in English because his Latin is excruciatingly difficult. Even my advisor, my doctoral age, who loved Latin, Tertullian, reduced him to say, golly, 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 because it's so fierce. But he was, again, to use the old Northeastern idiom, Tertullian was wound up tighter than an eight-day clock. I mean, I think having him in your congregation would be sort of like having to sleep in the same bed with a porcupine, that sort. But he was a tremendous thinker, one of the great thinkers, and I find him absolutely delightful to read, but you know, we have to be sure we're coach anyway. But he was one that believed that the soul actually had a body. Now that's a Stoic belief. He said when we talk about the soul departing the body, he says it has to have a body of its own or it couldn't depart. He didn't believe in osmosis or evaporation or disintegration or whatever. So he believed that the soul actually had a, well, I'll say physical for lack of a better word, a corporeal body. You find this in his treatise on the soul, the anima, which is very, very interesting, at least if you go to English. He took this idea that was strongly derivative from Stoicism, but also Tertullian was the one who believed in strong discipline, and of course the Stoics did. In later years, Tertullian actually left the church. At that time, we would say it was the Catholic Church, but that's actually an anachronism because back then it was just the church, because he thought they were getting too lax on discipline. And he joined a group called the Montanists, who were regarded as heretics because they were schismatic. They separated from the church, but their theology wasn't that bad. But boy, they believed if you're going to be disciplined, you got to do it with a vengeance. I mean, you got to hurt a little bit, you see. So he went that route. But obviously, this shows the influence of Stoicism with his idea about strong and stern discipline. One of his last treatises was called De Pudicitia, which would mean basically on modesty or whatever. And it's extreme. It's what the Britain, they would say, is over the top. But interesting? Oh, yes, absolutely. But you could see that he was one that was absolutely rabid for discipline. He said that there are some things which God can never forgive, or the church can never forgive. God may, but the church can't. I guess that means the church is more righteous than God, but Tertullian didn't say it that way. But we see that it showed this Stoic emphasis on discipline. And when we get to Augustine or Augustine, he answers to either one. He made use of Stoic logic on occasion. Stoics said they believed that two things could inhabit the same space, like oil and water. You know, they won't mix, but they will stay in the same space together. And he used this when he talked about the doctrine of the two natures in Christ, the divine and the human. He said they were both there in the body, that they were not mixed up in some sort of casserole fashion, but definitely that they could exist in the same place. Also, he liked the Stoic idea of ethics up to a point, because Augustine himself had been a swinger when he was a young man, and when he came to Christian faith, that changed, and so consequently, he was very careful about discipline as well, and he was also influenced by the Stoic idea of physics. So these are two very important ones among the Ante-Nicene fathers that were influenced by Stoicism. But by the time Augustine came along, we see that monasticism had begun. And that made an enormous difference. And this is what we'll look at as I try to wrap things up in a reasonable amount of time. It's a good thing I talk fast. You may have noticed that. I have slowed down, believe it or not. I always tell my students, I say, if we're getting them high on my lesson plan, I can always speak faster. And that's when they start popping the nitroglycerin tablets. Okay, as we look at monasticism, it started out probably in the 3rd century sometime. And at first, the ones that wanted to be monks or nuns, to use our later words, were hermits. But in the middle of the 3rd century, an Egyptian chap named Pachonius said it might be a better idea if we put them in groups, today what we would call monasteries or convents, because Pachonius very much realized that we are social creatures. There's times when we want to be by ourselves, very much so, but there's times when we need other people around. And sure enough, Pachonius's idea caught on. And guess what? Platonism reared its ugly head here in Stoicism. So anyway, because the idea is, if you're going to be a monk or a nun, then you are supposed to be fleeing from this imperfect world and getting ready to go off to the ideal world, the perfect world. You can see how Plato would fit right into that. And more this began to develop. Likewise, we see that the Alexandrian writer Origen, a most important chap, he takes 37 pages in my doctoral work, so I think he's very important, came up with this idea about how to interpret the scriptures, but there is a physical meaning, you know, it's just sort of icky and elementary. We've got to go on to the spiritual meaning, which again tied in with Plato's idea of this world being flawed, but the more spiritual meanings of scripture would tie in with the ideal world. And you better believe that the early monks and nuns followed along this as well. And then, of course, Augustine, before he became Christian, was a Neoplatonist, and so he firmly favored this sort of thinking as well, and so it began to take over, and Augustine sometimes gave the idea that sex could be sinful, for as he said, after he was 17 years old, he never went to bed unaccompanied until he became a Christian, so he perhaps overreacted at that particular point. But still, we see that sometimes he gave the idea that the body is sort of icky and yucky. I mean, terribly professional language, but you know what I mean. So this tied in with the monastic ideal as well. The emphasis on virginity. Now, St. Jerome, who was a brilliant textual scholar, but when it came to theology and some of his remarks, he could be an absolute baboon sometimes. He made the remark, he was so big on virginity and monks and nuns, he said, the only good thing about marriage is that it produces virgins. You know, to join convents or monasteries. I think that had a geranium, a cranium sometimes. But still, we see there is an idea of the inferiority of the body, which again would tie with Plato. Not that Plato was into abusing the body, but he said it is less good than what is spiritual. Later Platonists went a bit farther, and in some of the early days of monasticism, we find that some of those early monks and nuns really got into some heavy stuff. One staying on top of a pillar for 36 years and not coming down. I mean, he was, enough said. That was a St. Cyprian of Styla, if you're not familiar with that part of church history. Not for me. I got cranky knees and I can get up real fast. I'll say that. But you can see that this idea of the inferiority of the body, preparing to go to the ideal realm, the emphasis on virginity, looking past the pleasures of the flesh and getting off of the pleasures of the spirit, you can see how Plato would strongly enter into this sort of thing. There was also a problem, of course, in that Aristotle largely got lost. I think many of you are aware that it wasn't until the 1100s that the Islamic world retrieved Aristotle and brought him back into focus. A very important man, of course, but with his emphasis on this world, he might have provided a corrective to some of the Platonic excesses. By the way, Plato, I think, was quite good, no question there. But I'm talking about the excesses that some of these followers went into here. But now we see that in the monastery, also the idea of suffering almost was as fatalistic as the Stoics had been, and as you would find in the Islamic culture. You know that Islam says that anything that is beyond our control has to be the will of God. One of my professors in seminary remarked once that the Muslims would make good Calvinists. You see, the idea that everything is ordained by God there, and we see that sometimes this comes across in the early Christian writings. That's one place I'm a rebel, because I don't lay the suffering of the world at God's door. That's a different story. David Hume wouldn't like it at all, but still, that's me. Okay. So still we see that this began to develop in that time, and it's quite possible, and this is strictly a MacDonald idea, so please bear with it, that Stoicism began to lose out after Marcus Aurelius launched that persecution of the Christians and beyond. People that had read his meditations thought, wow, these are good. When they found out what he had done to other Christians in France, they would have dropped him like a hot potato, you see. So he lost out, and Stoicism along with it. And then, of course, we see in the monastery the idea of virtue was sort of metamorphosed into the idea of the likeness of Christ, and we're supposed to move toward that. But once again, that can be an ideal that sometimes minimizes what we go on here. So it was centuries before Thomas Aquinas came along in the Christian world. He died in 1274, and he was one that lived in the age when Aristotle had been rediscovered. And Aristotle actually became a bestseller, sort of like a new Harry Potter book, you know, that sort of thing. I think the last Harry Potter movie is due out today on DVD. But we see that he tried to set the record straight, but by then, custom, tradition, these had become encrusted and couldn't go much farther. But we see now, just in summary, looking back in those early days of Christianity, there was more of an influence of Stoicism than perhaps we realized before Plato shoved the Stoics back into a corner and took over at center stage. So I'll stop there, and if you've got questions, I'm not sure I'll have the answers, but I'll try. So you'll probably still be catching up with what I said 15 minutes ago. You're going to have to see what I can do. Maybe it was fake, but I still can't. Yes, sir.
You spoke about some disjunctive mechanical systems, and proving to that by logic, you talked about the the external thing controlled by faith, that we have power over our attitudes. What made Epictetus and the Stoics so sure that faith only controlled over the external, and that we actually had power over the internal?
I would say it probably is broken leg or something. If you read it, I would have some belief. And he said that I do not have to react with violence and rage and stuff, punch the torturer in the nose or whatever. He said, I'm going to rise above it. So I would say at least part of it must have been personal experience. But it was a good idea because it gave the idea that we're not just blind integers involved in life somewhere. There are some people in life that make things happen, and there are others, things just happen to them. One of my acquaintances in New York, he was actually one of my church members when I was pastoring up there, was one that things always happened to him, but he never, pardon the term, I won't tell you his name to make it back to him, he never showed enough gumption to take up and see that he was going to make things happen his way instead. He was more passive. And I think Epictetus said, we can do something about that. Now that's strictly a guess on my part, but I'll bet you, even if you already had the idea, that broken leg must have had something to do with it too. Strictly a guess. Who else? Yes, sir.
You talk about Tertullian and all of the people who adopted Stoic ideas of discipline, and part of that was controlling or being suspicious of the passion. So it seems that in doing that, they kind of became passionate themselves.
It wasn't passions per se, but it was when they ran amok. I mean, we see the New Testament is quite blunt, it says, for instance, in Hebrews, marriage is honorable, the good and defiled, but the idea of the orgy scenes and things like this were not there. Paul was definitely a passionate person, and Tertullian definitely was, so it said it depends, the passions need to be channeled into the proper direction, and we need to make sure, again, to use our illustration today, that they're not the drivers. That's what I say, because back when I was in high school, this is back in the dark ages, please remember. It seemed like there were so many times when boy meets girl, boy loves girl, smooch, 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 then they have a fight. The boy leaps into his car and runs off and wrecks the car around the tree and is killed. The girl comes in and says, it's all my fault, which it wasn't. But still, there was an idea that the emotions, the passions got in the driver's seat, you see. So again, this was the idea of Paul, Tertullian, all these others. Who's in control? And Epictetus would agree with this. Who's in control? You or your passion? Good question. Who else?
How do the Stoics, do they address the problem of evil?
Not really. Not as well as they could have, because they said, that's why I'm saying, things that are beyond us, we don't have any control over. So I find that they were a bit limited at that point. Augustine took the farmer idea, he said, and it was not his own idea to start with, but he majored on it, that evil is merely where good is not. It's merely an absence of good. It's a negative quality. And that I like because he says that evil does not really have a positive existence. It can only live as a counterfeit. I mean, the idea was God comes up with love. We could twist it into jealousy or hatred or lust, but without love, evil could not survive because all it can do is twist and do things like that. It's like in the old hymn that some of you may have heard in Sunday school, this is my Father's world, or let me never forget that though the wrong seem all so strong, God is the ruler yet. And that was the idea, and I think that's wonderfully helpful if we realize that when we hear about the horrors of things like 9/11 or whatever, that still, evil is only can live a parasite existence. So that I think is good. The Stoics, that's one place where I think they were a bit weak. because they did not address that as thoroughly as some other issues did.
Well, had that issue even been fleshed out back in that era as much?
It was mentioned, certainly with, like, every guy, every Titus in his broken leg, he knew that was evil. But his idea was, when evil happens, rise above it. But they didn't question the source, because of them it was to lie its fate. Plato would have said it's just part of an inferior world, and of course he tended to think that matter was something inferior in itself. And that he talked about matter and spirit, he was the absolute dichotomist at that point. But I think that the question, and Aristotle was more interested in natural sciences, but he did believe in the possibility of excess. If you read his Nicomachean Ethics, we find he talked about keeping things in balance, of what constituted virtue, etc. If any of you want to go into an exercise in masochism, I strongly recommend Aristotle's Metaphysics. I read that once. I felt like I was swimming in molasses in January in Vermont, outdoors. You get the idea. But I felt much better when I read what the Islamic Aristotelian specialist, Avicenna, said back in the 1100s. He said he had read the Metaphysics 40 times and had yet to make heads or tails out. I felt much better when I said, this is what's coming, you know? Really good question, sir. Who else? Go all speak at once now.
I keep thinking about the German man who was in a concentration camp, who his whole philosophy that he wrote about was rising above the situation. Mm-hmm. I can't remember his name.
No, I mean, it was Victor Frankl. Yes,
that's right.
And it's interesting to see that he was, I think, an atheist, but he still took this idea, which the Stoics would certainly have agreed with. Yes, I was thinking of Elie Wiesel, which is a little bit like that. But yes, Frankl said, they don't have to turn me bitter.
Right.
That's right. Which, I mean, that's the idea that we have control over the attitude. Good point. Thank you so much for bringing that up. That's right. And again, it's like the Job. Job sounded off, but he wasn't to the end of the story yet. And I think Victor Frankl would have said that. And he lasted a long time after the concentration camps. And Elie Wiesel, of course, is still with us, you see. But they, I used to be a member of the YMCA in Glens Falls, New York. And there was a man there, a Jewish man, who had still had the brand on the arms, you see. And yet he was a very sweet-spirited man. He would talk about it, and he was sorry and sad about it, but he did start raging about it because he had dealt with that, and he said that was in the past, and he was, I say, a really nice champion, and he had risen above that. Yes, sir.
When you mentioned that the Stoics view God as an impersonal force of nature, I have a book on Epictetus by somebody named Long. I do remember not what he said about the religion aspect, but I do remember there was a copy of Ode or a Hymn to Zeus.
Yes.
Now my question is about Epictetus. Did he believe in a personalized Zeus, or was he thinking of Zeus as more of a force of nature?
This is going to sound political. Probably yes and no. No, I would say that it's like Plato. He talked about the existence of one God, and yet he offered sacrifices, as did Socrates, to Zeus, Hera, all the rest. Remember back then, there was absolutely no idea of separation of religion and state, and the idea was that these gods were the ones who protected Athens or whatever, and if you didn't sacrifice to them, you might be undermining the security of the country. And see, that's exactly what happened after Theodosius, the emperor, made Christianity the state religion of the Roman Empire. He died in 395, I think it was. Well, in 410, you know, Alaric the Goth sacked Rome, and some of the old pagans said, Christian gods are wimp. If Jupiter and Juno and Minerva had still been around, this wouldn't have happened. And Augustine says, are you kidding? And he wrote that massive work that we call The City of God, talking about God's dealings in history. So I would say that Epictetus, again, probably had the same idea that if you don't talk about the gods or write to them, he wanted to play it safe. And again, he said if they are there, we want to make sure that we're giving them proper deference. He would not have described himself as an atheist, but probably an agnostic. And Plato, while he went through all these sacrifices and things, still liked to talk about God as basically one. Yeah. Good point. And Aristotle did the same thing, but his God, the unmoved mover, does not seem to have much care or personality or what we would call human or humane qualities, let's put it that way. But it was more of a logical deduction than a deeply held theological belief, I'll put it that way. Send more of our somebody on Capitol Hill on that. Okay. Who else?
Anybody?
Okay, yes, please.
You talked about them thinking of life as cyclical.
Yes.
Do they have anything to say about the
They tended to think both, right? But I think they would say no afterlife in the sense of a heaven or any Elysian fields or anything like that. But they would say that life will be wrapped up, we die, that's it, and then the whole thing will be recycled somewhere down the line. There were occasions when Origen approached that. The Christian thing, a very fascinating figure, a very unusual figure, a bit wacko at times, but fun to translate. But I think the Stoics would have regarded the idea of an afterlife as problematic. We'll say that, and they might say, well, it might be there, but we don't know for sure, and this is what we think. So I think usually they were gracious and mannerly about this sort of thing. Yes, sir, please.
And following on with your question, Dan, is did the Stoics then attempt to say, why are we here if it's just going to be 80 years, 60 yeah. years, yeah. and we
kick off
dust to dust, you know, yes. ashes to ashes? Well, what is yeah. there, did they address the purpose question, I guess, in a
not so much today. It was more like the idea of learning how to live a productive life, make it work now. Let's remember that the Sadducees, who were the high priestly bunch in Jerusalem at the time of Jesus, they didn't believe in life after death.
No, they didn't.
And so the idea was that rather we want to serve God here and make life work for us, and that was it. I tell them they didn't believe in life after death. I tell my students that's why they were sad, you see. Okay. That's two words. But it helps them remember the text. Yes, sir.
Is there a connection between the Stoics? The Spartans, yeah. Because the Spartans had a very austere lifestyle and parliamentary.
But Sparta was not into writing, so not that much. So we don't know a great deal about them. I was looking at a travel guide to Greece just today. There's almost nothing of ancient Sparta left. They were so big, and the physical prowess, this and that. We know about Leonidas, this tremendous stand that Thermopylae, many of you probably saw the movie there, the 300, which I thought was highly enjoyable. Not very realistic. Greece never had mountains that look like that. We know about them for that, but they didn't leave a great literary legacy. You see, the Athenians did that. So as to what the Spartans believe, we honestly can't say, but they believed in survival no matter what. And of course, they were in that incredible discipline. The story about the child or boy that had found a fox and had it under his toe, that he was actually gnawing at his stomach, but he didn't want to show any facial expression because the Spartans were supposed to hang tough, you see. So, that's for them and not me, I'll say that. Yes, sir.
Origen was considered a heretic on several of his major
yes.
themes of the church. How much later did the church get considered him a heretic?
About 300 years. We find that his stuff was condemned as heretical during the time of Justinian, the emperor who was emperor of Constantinople, in the 6th century. And Origen died about 257. When I was doing my work on him, I said it's really probably not fair to call him a heretic, but a pre-heretic. He was dealing with issues that no one looked at yet. And some of them are definitely a bit wanky. His idea about four senses or three senses, it varies from time to time, on scripture, this and that, and yet I owe him a great deal because he was the first writer I dealt with, all whose writings are not available in English. And I had my own share of problems with self-image, I'll be honest. And he was the one that showed me that I could translate the Greek and the Latin. In spite of his brilliance, he kept it simple. I appreciate that. If I started with someone else like Theodore Mopsuestia, I would have dropped out the first term. I have one article in print who's about Theodore Mopsuestia. But Origen, well, I came up with these ideas, but they were just ideas, tossing them out. But we see that by the time of Justinian, these were regarded as dangerous, and therefore he was condemned 300 years after his death. Somehow it only didn't bother him too much. He had already been excommunicated by the bishop in Alexandria because he had been ordained a presbyter outside of Alexandria, up in Palestine, and his bishop, whose name was Demetrius, got very, very upset with him, had excommunicated him, but Origen didn't seem to pay much attention to that, you see. So, but it was not over his doctrine as much as it was what he did in procedure. So I'd say pre-heretic is probably a better word for it. Interesting to read, he comes across as a pretty nice guy, really. When you read things there. If you told him that he was a heretic, he would have been amazed. He said, really? Why? Show me how. If you proved it to him, well, okay, I'll change that. So he was one that was willing to think. He kept an open mind that way. He was one that his dad was, who was a martyr, in the persecution under Septimius Severus. Augustine was 14 years old and wanted to go and be martyred with him. His mother gave his clothes, and he refused to be martyred in the nude, so he survived sort of the day. But he did suffer persecutions under Decius and the wife of that Valentinian prince, and he was so badly damaged that when he did die a few years later, they felt it was because of the stuff he had been through there. He was living in Palestine at that time, Caesarea. I'd like to have not told what his library, but it's long gone. Who else? Yes, sir. Oh, then there's some attitudes. You know, some people are just in control of their moods, and we need to say, now look, I'm not going to be this way. I'm going to be more positive. I'm not going to be gloomy. I'm going to get on top of this. So that's when you say you kick the mood out and say, I'm not going to let it control me. I've known people that are strictly, if they think, if they're having a bad day, as far as they're concerned, the sun didn't come up, you know, well, guess what? It did. So, this is something I've had to learn some things about as well. But there's the idea that if we are just batted back and forth by our moods, we're pathetic. And that's when we can say, now wait just a moment, and just because I feel like punching somebody out doesn't mean I ought to do it. I do that on occasion. I feel like I ought to do it, you know. But there's not, there's a few students that are strong arguments for justifiable homicide, but I haven't followed through on it yet. So there's that idea that I can be in control of my moods at that point, and I can still try to work for their best good, which of course is the definition of agape love. It has nothing to do with our feelings, but it's working for that other person's best good, no matter how we feel. So I think that's good.
Why don't we do two more questions?
Okay, please.
No, go ahead.
Okay. Yes, you again first, please, and then the gentleman next to you here.
I keep thinking about the difference between context and content.
Yes.
How that context is who you are.
That's right. You have got control over
that. Content is the stuff going on in your life, and the trick is to stay out of your stuff.
And also to know where we may be victims of our own environment and realize this is a place where we may be wrong because of that, and realize that what we've grown up with is going to color the way we look at things.
Right.
Absolutely. You could not be brighter if you tried. Yes. And you, sir.
Let me preface my question by pointing out that some philosophers believe that the idea of natural law is humbug, it's passé. Now points to Rorty as one, and Rorty points to Dewey as another. And somebody named Becker, have you seen his book on a new stoicism?
Well, I know his name, but I have not come across the book.
So I read a review of it because I thought, oh, a new stoicism. Well, the review of it said he's reformulating a modern stoicism that throws out natural law. And I go, oh, it's just like, well, yeah, Christianity is throwing God out.
That's right.
I don't see how you can have stoicism and not have a link to natural law.
Unless it's on the idea of personal behavior. That might be the one thing. He's talking about how to behave in our own lives to rise above the world around us.
What I hear is he points to psychology, and he tries to look at modern science to replace natural law.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, the Stoics, if they had lived our time here, would probably have said they wouldn't see that much differentiation between science and natural law. The sun rises, we know how it rises, whatever, and they say that's natural, but it's also scientific. So I think that people are trying to make a wide differentiation there. The Stoics wouldn't want it. But no, Becker, I have not come across yet. That particular look. It may be in our library at Texas Wesleyan. My office used to be in the library, but now it's in a different building, so I don't get to the library corrections office. I should.
But Rorty also believes that the world around us, we really can't say that remember how Galileo said that mathematics is a language of nature?
Yes.
And he said, humbug, there is a language of nature. That's what the word said.
And Descartes thought that everything could be solved by mathematics. One of my students put it in the margin on his test there. A really bad idea.